Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, June 15th, 2020. This is Section A. The front page headline reads, Robert E. Lee descendant was born in Midland. A UT at Dallas library collection paper shows a direct descendant of the famous general was born here, served as a military pilot, and was in the oil business, by Stuart Doreen. Apparently there was a Robert E. Lee from Midland. Papers from the collection at the University of Texas at Dallas show a direct descendant of the famous Civil War general was born in Midland, served during two world wars, and had a successful career in the oil business. Robert Edward Lee, a pioneer aviator, was born in Midland on March 9, 1886, according to a biographical sketch from the Robert E. Lee papers, which are part of the Collections Department, McDermott Library at UTD. Lee, who died September 13, 1973, enrolled in the Wright Flying School, owned and operated by Wilbur and Orville Wright, and was a member of the first graduating class, according to the biographical sketch. In World War I, he commanded the 47th Aero Squadron in France, according to the sketch that was put together by Paul A. Olkrug in March 2003. His squadron's area of operations meant that they often went up against the Red Baron's flying circus, the sketch stated. In fact, Lee himself encountered the Red Baron on an observational mission. Upon spotting the Red Baron's plane, Lee stated, "I just ran away from him. I did not feel up to fighting him." Lee was shot down twice in World War I, including the day before the armistice was signed. Lee again entered the U.S. Army Air Force in World War II, serving as the commanding officer of the 55th Air Depot, Des Moines Airfield. He eventually obtained the rank of lieutenant colonel. Lee was involved in the oil business as a civilian, according to the biographical sketch. He founded Lee Geophysical Company and invented the Lee Angular Drill, for which he received a patent. The sketch also said he made the West Texas city of Coleman his home. He died there at the age of 87. The Reporter Telegram talked with Olkrug, who lives in the Dallas suburb of Carrollton, on Sunday. He said that the collection from which the biographical sketch was written was small, but really rich in information. The Lee papers state the collection includes a scanned image of an engine serial number plate from the Wright Flyer Type B, a facsimile of a training agreement between Lee and the Wright Flying Company, military records, photocopies of military ribbons and medals, photographs of Lee flying a Wright Flyer, portraits of Lee during World War I and World War II, and an aviator's certificate from the Aero Club of America. This article is entitled Petitions Created to Keep Lee High School Name by Stuart Doreen. There are dueling petitions involving the name of Robert E. Lee High School in Midland. One day, after a Midland man created a petition calling for the high school's name to be changed, a man from Cyprus in the Houston area has started his own change.org petition to Lee High School alumni and the Midland ISD school board to keep the name Robert E. Lee High School. The man who created the petition is Bruce Carter, and according to the website, it was created about 10 a.m. Sunday. As of 6.05 p.m. Sunday, he had collected 415 supporters. A petition to change the name, which was created Saturday afternoon, had accumulated 1,145 signatures as of 6 p.m. The petition states that the high school should retain the Robert E. Lee name because Robert E. Lee was an honorable man, an abolitionist, a patriot that only fought on the side of the Confederacy because he refused to take up arms against his native Virginia. Generations and graduates of Lee High School have accomplishments and honors linked to the school. Graduates who use their high school graduation as a reference for potential employment deserve better than to have no such school found on background checks by potential employers. The name change is nothing more than misguided white guilt that will do nothing in the broad scheme of racial relations in this country. We do not believe that renaming the school after a divisive leftist will do anything to improve race relations, the petition states. In fact, the backlash it creates may do more harm than good. Two other petitions were created Sunday to keep the Robert E. Lee High School name. The petition to U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, Governor Greg Abbott, and Midland ISD had picked up 152 signatures as of 6:20 p.m. The other petition, by Esteban Ramirez to the Midland Independent School District, had been created about the time this story was being written. There was also a petition started in 2017 by those interested in keeping the name of the school. The petition to Superintendent Orlando Riddick, Mayor Jerry Morales, and the Midland City Council picked up 1,030 supporters, according to the change.org website. The following is the petition started by Bruce Carter to keep the name of Robert E. Lee High School in Midland. We, the undersigned, believe that Robert E. Lee High School should retain its present name. Our reasons: 1. We believe that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man, an abolitionist, a patriot that only fought on the side of the Confederacy because he refused to take up arms against his native state, Virginia. His military record prior to the Civil War alone would more than make him worthy of the honor of having schools named in his honor. Generations of Robert E. Lee High School graduates have accomplishments and honors linked to the school, all of which would be erased and forgotten if the school got a new name. There are graduates that use their high school graduation as a reference for potential employment, based on the excellent education they have received. They deserve better than to have, quote, no such school found, unquote, on background checks by potential employers. The name change is nothing more than misguided white guilt that will do nothing in the broad scheme of racial relations in this country. We do not believe that renaming the school after a divisive leftist will do anything to improve race relations. In fact, the backlash it creates may do more harm than good. We oppose any name change for Robert E. Lee High School.
Hello, this is April, reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Monday, June 15, 2020. City pools to open on alternate days. Doug Russell Pool and Washington Family Aquatic Center are open, but because of staffing and coronavirus limitations, are operating on alternate days. Russell will be open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Washington will be open Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. Both pools will be closed on Mondays for maintenance and training. Entry passes, which are $3, will be sold for three-hour sessions. They go on sale at the pool 30 minutes before the posted opening times and are good only for the day of purchase. Punch cards will not be sold this year. Because of staffing limitations and coronavirus precautions, there won't be private parties, lap swim times, swimming lessons, or family nights. Pool furniture will be removed from both pools, but swimmers will be allowed to bring chairs. The schedule is Washington, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday and Friday, 1 to 4 p.m. and 5 to 8 p.m. Sunday. Doug Russell, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. VA official to host phone town hall. Paul Lawrence, Undersecretary for Benefits at the Department of Veterans Affairs, is hosting a toll-free telephone town hall with Texas veterans beginning at 4 p.m. Tuesday. To participate, call 844-227-7557. Lawrence will take veterans' questions live over the phone and will inform veterans of new and existing benefits available to them, such as the Blue Water Navy program and efforts to combat veteran suicide, according to a press release from VA. This town hall is one in a series of calls connecting VA's leadership with veterans across the country. Library extends curbside service. Midland County Public Library has extended its curbside service at the downtown branch. Hours are now 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., Monday through Friday. Patrons may reserve materials online and will receive an email with instructions for curbside pickup. The branches, which are open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday during coronavirus, will continue reserving the first hour of each day for at-risk patrons, such as those 65 or older, and children 5 or younger, accompanied by an adult. Groups may not exceed 10 people, and field trip activities are not available. Notary services, passport acceptance, and meeting room reservations are not yet available at either branch, according to a press release from the library. Use of the genealogy department is available by appointment only and may be scheduled by calling 742-7400. Grocery store hours during coronavirus. Albertsons Market, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., 1002 Andrews Highway. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. 3317 North Midland Drive. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday. HEB, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Customers 60+. Orders can be called in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 833-397-0080. Groceries will be delivered by Favor Delivery. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com. Market Street, 6 a.m. to midnight. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. 7 to 8 a.m. curbside delivery pickup for first responders and customers 60+, with disabilities or at risk. Today in Texas history. In 1993, former Texas Governor John Connally, who was wounded in the gunfire that killed President John F. Kennedy, died in Houston at age 76.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "Many Offices May Not Reopen Anytime Soon," by Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. I almost hesitate to mention this because it seems so obvious, but here goes. If you used to work in a high-rise and are now working at home, then odds are that come December 31st, you will still be someone who used to work in a high-rise and now works from home. Ignore these cheerful notes from Human Resources, assuring you that a committee of the very best people is working hard on getting you back into the office. What the committee has undoubtedly found is that the problem of getting large numbers of people back into the office is difficult, probably insuperable, until we get a vaccine. Start with the elevators, the core of high-rise development, both physically and operationally. It doesn't feel very safe to cram yourself in cheek by jowl with up to a dozen other people, all breathing on each other, in what is essentially a poorly ventilated closet. However, if we don't all cram in together during peak hours, then in a building of any significant height, it quickly becomes impossible to transfer people to their floors in a timely manner. Moreover, the wait for the elevator will itself become unsafe as people queue in a space that wasn't designed for it. This problem can be alleviated to some extent by requiring people to bring lunch and staggering their arrivals and departures, although that is possibly hard to coordinate in a building that houses multiple firms. But now imagine that you have patiently waited in line for an elevator shared with 1 to 3 other people and have arrived at your floor. Close your eyes and remember what it looks like. Most probably decades of, quote, open office, unquote, evangelism, abetted by firms searching for lower real estate costs, have placed you in essentially a large version of the elevator, a sealed box, not very well ventilated, in which large numbers of people are crammed together with nothing much between them to stop germs from traveling freely. And it has air conditioning, which may help droplets travel even further. If a super spreader gets into an environment like this, it is fiesta time for the COVID-19 virus. Since the advent of the internet, there have been a lot of unfulfilled prophecies about the end of the office. These prophets failed because underneath our jackets and button-down shirts were just glorified monkeys evolved to do things in a group. We're better at reading subtle social cues face-to-face and more loyal and collegial with people that way fairly frequently, learning our coworkers not just as screen names, but as people we chat idly with over coffee. Moreover, that idle chat often spurs unexpected ideas that can turn into a new product or a new sale. You can believe in the office while recognizing that it just doesn't work in the time of COVID-19. You can keep some people home to make it easier to put distance between the remaining workers and have the folks who come in wear masks. But take a minute to go over the mechanics of this in your head and then ask, why bother? People can't read those subtle social cues when 2/3 of someone's face is covered by a mask, nor will they want to stand close to one person chatting, or worse, close to many holding a meeting. And there's not much point in holding a meeting with only half your team. You're still going to have to hop on teleconference software, at which point it might actually be better if everyone is at home so you can look at each other's faces. Stripped of the social contact that makes offices so production, mostly you're left with an annoying and possibly dangerous commute and the physical discomfort of strapping a piece of cloth across your mouth and nose for 8 hours. This is what those committees all over the country are discovering right now, though they may not be quite ready to admit it. Certainly, some office workers need to be physically in place. People who work on necessary equipment, such as servers, people who need to collaborate on complicated visual problems that don't lend themselves well to screen sharing. Others may simply find it impossible to work in their homes because of intrusive family or roommates. But as for the rest, what is the point of hauling them into the office? Quite possibly on public transit, just to have them hunch miserably at their lonely desks, sweating into their masks. Better, as the saying goes, to stay safe, stay home. This article is entitled Guest View. Chinese Russians don't understand American protests. If there is one thing we can count on from Russia and China, it's to kick us while we're down. The U.S. is reeling now, as we should be, from national protests over the unjust killing of George Floyd and a long overdue reckoning with racism and police brutality. But in another disoriental signal of the surrealism overtaking everyday life in our nation, we must deal now with lectures from autocrats and authoritarians whose sense of freedom runs exactly as far as it serves their own interests. Beyond that, well, disappearing and death are on the menu. Predictably, China has mocked the U.S. for hypocrisy, citing broadly expressed concerns about the crackdown in protests in Hong Kong. The overly aggressive response of police to protesters here opened the door for the charge. But it's worth noting that the protesters in the streets of Hong Kong are risking everything for the rights we have here, rights that must be respected for our own protesters. And of course, we say this loudly and proudly without fear as the local press. Russia's foreign ministry, Arma strongman Vladimir Putin, had a similar criticism. Putin has been in power since 1999, as Russia has descended even deeper into an aggressive totalitarian state with the name of accruing power by diminishing democracies throughout the world. And nowhere more than America. Even as they lecture us publicly, Russia and China are using social media in the way it works best, to stoke social division. As Politico reported last week, both nations are flooding Twitter with material hashtagged to George Floyd's death. The idea is to make the U.S. appear to be a hypocritical nation on the brink of unraveling. What these abusive regimes fail to recognize is America's freedom is its strength. What they see is an unraveling, because they all fear unrest, we understand as evolving. America can struggle through pain and discord toward reform and harmony because we have the freedom to engage in that struggle as a people. Even now, on the streets and in city halls and in state houses and in our nation's capital, we are considering how we can become a better America. We will argue, and we will disagree, and we will vote, and we will change. The struggle on the streets is a part of our becoming what the Russian and Chinese regimes cannot accept, because to accept it would require subjecting themselves to the will of the people. And instead, they opt to silence their people. What should be evident from what's happening in America today is that our people are not silenced. Our people are demanding their rights, and they will be heard. This column is from the Dallas Morning News, distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is entitled "Hate Police Violence, Love America" by Ruben Navarrete, Washington Post Writers Group. Although I applaud the arrests of the four ex-Minneapolis police officers charged in the death of George Floyd and hope they get jail time, something has been bothering me about the protests. It's just not the looting, arson, rioting, and violence. That's bad enough. We need to see arrests and jail time for those crimes as well. I finally put my finger on the issue thanks to Floyd's niece, Brooke Williams, who spoke last week at Floyd's funeral in Houston. What bugs me is the attitude of the protesters. They're raging, and they have reason to rage. Yet many of them have abandoned reason. They're not just cutting off their noses to spite their faces, they're cutting their heads off. Before I unpack that, here's a story that hits close to home. As a Mexican-American, I reserve 100% of my love and gratitude for the American part of that phrase. In fact, I'm more of an American-Mexican. As such, I've always been baffled by Mexicans living in the United States who claim to love Mexico, even with all its flaws, which include a broken government that can't provide enough opportunities for its own people. Sure, Mexicans in the United States have the prerogative to love a country that turned its back on them. Still, for many years, I just didn't get it. For me, Mexico is the country that cast off my grandfather as a boy because he had no money, dark skin, and a sixth-grade education. To heck with Mexico. Then some of my Mexican friends taught me that for them, Mexico is much bigger than its incompetent and corrupt government. In fact, most Mexicans separate the two. They hate the government, but love the country. Now let's go back to the protests and what Williams told those who gathered at the Fountain of Praise Church for Floyd's funeral. The mourners had come to grieve for an ordinary man who became a martyr for the cause of ending police violence. But before they left, they got a dose of politics. In a dig at President Donald Trump, Williams declared, "Someone said, 'Make America great again.' But when has America ever been great?" "Excuse me?" If Floyd's family and the protesters want to hate on the cops in Minneapolis who killed him, that's understandable. If they want to extend that resentment to Trump, that's fine too. And if they want to go further and profile all cops the way that many cops profile African Americans and Latinos, that may not be helpful, but it does have a poetic ring to it. But how about we leave America out of this? Otherwise, in my head, all this country boy hears is Merle Haggard. "When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me." Listening to Williams, I thought to myself, someone needs a history lesson, followed by a course in civics. That goes double for those vandals who have, during the protests, spray-painted buildings with the word "America." KKK. Such foolishness. What America are they talking about? What America do they see as systematically racist, made from the same cloth as the Ku Klux Klan? Not the one I know. Racism will never disappear. But if those who are upset over Floyd's death keep talking nonsense, their allies will. America isn't perfect, and it has never been perfect. Its sins include enslaving African Americans, slaughtering Native Americans, stealing of the Southwest from Mexico, and the internment of Japanese Americans, just to name a few. But the genius of the place is that it has a computer chip deep inside that allows it to correct its imperfections. It has a brilliant system of checks and balances to keep any branch of government from eroding the rights of citizens. It's a safe bet that it has, over the last couple of hundred years, spilled more blood to liberate the people of other countries than most nations have to defend their own people. The world is full of countries driven by self-interest, where people look out for their own kind. That's not how we roll. Only in America will you see corporations fire CEOs who make insensitive remarks about Floyd or his death. Only in America will you see police officers marching with protesters who call for the defunding of police departments. Only in America will you see a little white girl holding up a sign on a street corner that reads, "Black Lives Matter." That's my America. And is it great? You had better believe it.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, June 15th. The Other Virus. This is a guest column by Carol Cates, the chief nursing officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. Many, many years ago, I was caring for a patient that was end of life, and the family was struggling with making decisions about their loved one's care. At one family conference, one of the physicians said in the kindest possible way, quote, "Unfortunately, no decision is also a decision. When you choose not to make a decision, you choose to lose control of the outcome," end quote. I know that sounds a bit brutal, but it did help the family realize that in making a decision, they had a say in the outcome. In this case, it helped the family make the best decision for their loved one's final days. Several members of the family told me later they were so glad the doctor had said those words. I have thought about those words often over the years and have said them to people that I care about when they are faced with a difficult decision that they would rather avoid. But I don't think I have thought about them more than during the last few weeks after the events surrounding the death of George Floyd, and far too many people in our history that have been treated poorly for no other reason than discrimination. I have thought about them because of this article. Should I say something about those events, or should I not? Is it easier not to make a decision? And if I do make a decision, what does that say about me, about my job, and about my role as a nurse? Since I am telling you all of this, I am pretty sure you know I decided to make the decision to talk about those events. I try to refrain from discussing cultural and social topics in my column and focus on health issues. What I decided is this fits both of those categories of social and health issues. I genuinely believe discrimination and injustice based on race, age, gender, religion, sexual orientation, or any other difference is not a social issue. It is an ethical issue. Discrimination is in many ways a virus. It is contagious and it costs lives. In 1950, the American Nurses Association developed the Code of Ethics for Nurses. It has had a few revisions in the 70 years since its inception, but one phrase has not changed, and it is, quote, "Respect the inherent dignity, worth, unique attributes, and human rights of all individuals," end quote. Those of us in the healthcare field are very fortunate because I think we get to see that ultimately we are all the same because, in the words of the nursing theorist Gene Watson, quote, "We have the joy and privilege of caring for others at their most vulnerable," end quote. No matter our race, age, gender, sexual orientation, or any other difference you can name, we all experience joy and we all experience suffering. We all suffer from disease and injury, and we all have good and evil within us. We are all afraid, and overcoming that fear has nothing to do with the things that separate us. It has everything to do with the thing we have in common, our humanity. I am so glad we live in a country where we can talk about these things and where people can openly and peacefully protest when behaviors and ethics collide. Discrimination is a virus that has a cure. And in America, we can lead the world, as we always do, in finding that cure. But we can only cure the virus of discrimination if we as a society make a decision and choose to control the outcome, one of equality and justice for every person with no exceptions. COVID-19 news. By the numbers, Ector County confirmed cases, 238. Ector County negative, 2,999 out of 3,392 tested, with 155 pending. 6 deaths. Midland County, 201 confirmed cases and 13 deaths. Texas, 87,854 confirmed cases with 1,463,851 tested. Total Texas deaths, 1,976. U.S. cases, 2,063,812 total cases confirmed and 115,271 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Main Street Unplugged. Basin PBS has scheduled live Main Street Unplugged quarterly music series premiering at 7 p.m. June 25th and will air live from inside the Basin PBS Anwar Family Studio. In keeping with the annual concert theme of Main Street and music, the series will feature local and national music artists showcasing different styles and genres, something for everyone. The first featured artist will be Scott Kirby. Kirby is an accomplished singer, songwriter, and performer, and has been known to take the stage with the likes of Carole King, Jimmy Buffett, Tom Rush, Peter Meyer, and others. For more information on upcoming episodes, visit www.basinpbs.org or on Facebook. TARP. Ellen Noel Art Museum, 4909 East University Boulevard, has scheduled Teen Artist Residency Program display at 6 p.m. June 26th. This year's TARP artists will work under the instruction of artist Alice Lease. Selected students, ages 13 to 17, will spend the week of June 22nd through 26th creating paintings with acrylic and watercolors. On June 26th, their work will be on display. The event is free. To enroll or for more information, call 550-9696 or visit noelartmuseum.org.
Odessa American Opinion Page, Monday, June 15th. National View. Confederate monuments are a historical lie. The Point. That part of American history needs to stay where it belongs, in books and museums. Suppose you were strolling through Forest Park and came across a flattering statue of Adolf Hitler, or Fidel Castro, or Osama bin Laden. Of course, nations don't generally bestow statuary upon enemies, unless those enemies happen to be Confederate leaders in the Civil War. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's call to remove a statue in the state capital, Richmond, of Confederate General Robert E. Lee should be only the beginning. These monuments to slavery and treason don't belong in positions of honor in public spaces. For 130 years, the 60-foot-tall monument, topped with the bronze statue of Lee on horseback, has towered over downtown Richmond, the former capital of the Confederacy, and now a majority black city. For modern African-American citizens to have to walk in the shadow of the man who led the crusade to preserve slavery is a daily slap in the face. Indeed, to many Americans supportive of racial justice amid recent reminders of how elusive it still is. Northam's move followed protests that have swept Virginia, as in Missouri, and around the nation, over the death of George Floyd in the custody of Minneapolis police. Northam's announcement noted the false version of history that pretends the Civil War was about state rights and not the evils of slavery. It's not the only history of the Civil War that's too often falsified, but also the history of the statues, Confederate flags, and other Civil War symbolism. While the 1890 Lee statue is an exception, much of that symbolism around America arose in the early to mid-20th century, when the war itself was a distant memory. But Jim Crow oppression of black citizens was in full swing. Those symbols were looming reminders to African Americans of where they stood, even generations after emancipation. St. Louis knows something about this. 3 years ago, a 32-foot-tall, 40-ton monument that had stood in Forest Park since 1914, idealizing a Confederate soldier going off to war, became the center of controversy in light of modern racial strife. Mayor Lyda Crewson ultimately had the monument dismantled and taken away by the Missouri Civil War Museum in Jefferson Barracks, with the agreement that any future display of it would be in a museum or other appropriate setting. A federal judge last week temporarily halted the removal of the Lee statue to consider a lawsuit claiming Virginia is contractually obligated to affectionately protect it in perpetuity. That promise, made at the dawn of the Jim Crow era, should hold no weight today, when even the U.S. military is, at least considering, removing the names of Confederate leaders from its bases. This isn't, as some wrongly claim, an attempt to purge the Confederacy from history, but to keep that history where it belongs, in history books and museums, not to be celebrated in the public square. Column by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Odessa American, Death Notices, Monday, June 15th. Guadalupe Lupe Morales Loera. Guadalupe Lupe Morales Loera, 60, died Friday, June 12th in Chihuahua, Mexico. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Bertha Ann Najera Lopez. Bertha Ann Najera Lopez, 60, with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, June 14th, 2020. Section A. MISD hears from opposition about bond. School board members, district staff, hear from those who had opposed 2019 proposal. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. Those deemed to be most publicly outspoken opponents to November's Midland ISD bond had their chance to tell district leaders about their expectations for a future bond. Over the course of five meetings, 19 different Midlanders provided feedback to five different questions. What would you like to see included again as part of any future bond proposal? What would you not like to see included again as part of any future bond proposal? What would you like to see included as part of any future bond proposal that was not included in the last proposal? What thoughts do you have on how the process in formulating a future bond proposal should work? And what thoughts do you have on how the community should be educated and informed about the components of any future bond proposal? Midland ISD Board President Rick Davis said this was one step in a long journey. He said during multiple meetings, the earliest he could see the district approaching the community with the next bond would be November 2021. He and other leaders also said during these meetings, which numbered about 7.5 hours, that they expected a more thorough assessment of the community before board members approve a plan. The decision to have a lengthier runway was a reaction, they said, to initial comments they heard about the process that preceded the narrow defeat of a $569 million bond last year. The meetings weren't a dialogue as much as an opportunity for residents selected by the district to say what they thought. The residents were opinion makers who were involved in efforts, including through social media, to voice their opposition to the plan in place last fall. The following are takeaways from the 5 sessions held on 5 different evenings between June 2nd and June 11th at 5 different elementary schools across Midland. There never were more than 3 board members at a meeting, along with Midland ISD staff, but all board members attended at least 2 of the meetings. When it comes to comprehensive high schools, 2's company and 3's a crowd. The November bond proposal called for Midland ISD to move to 3 larger comprehensive high schools. During the conversations, there was support only for MISD's current arrangement, keeping Midland High and Lee as the only comprehensive high schools. As one woman stated, the bond in November passes hands down if it was 2 high schools. Participants said presenting a 3rd high school provided too many concerns, including questions about boundaries. In a community where some still buy a home based on whether a student will be a bulldog or a rebel, knowing boundaries matter. As a former employee at the meeting of Bush Elementary added, Midland already has multiple comprehensive high schools. The private schools and Greenwood High School, which is located outside city limits, but still inside Midland County. And multiple people mentioned that if 2 new campuses were built, turning the current Lee campus into an alternative campus would be preferable. That campus could cater to career and technical education students who don't intend to attend college. That solution, it was stated, would still help fulfill Midland ISD's mission for all students to graduate ready and prepared for college or a career. 9th grade campuses not needed. Even the most vocal opponents were in agreement that the reconfiguration sought in the November bond would be a positive. They liked the idea of moving 9th graders to the main high school campuses. There wasn't as much insistence about moving 6th graders to the junior highs, but the ayes still outnumbered the nays, including one woman of the Yarborough Elementary meeting who said she had a daughter at San Jacinto Junior High, which does have 6th graders on campus, and her daughter loved being in a different configuration. In general, when facilities and needs were talked about, the high schools garnered most of the discussion, and reconfiguration was not a reason for their opposition. There are still buildings to maintain. During multiple sessions, it was mentioned that building new facilities was hard to support when there were maintenance issues at numerous campuses. One woman even used existing problems at meeting location number 3, Santa Rita Elementary, to make her point. Other issues talked about including the water problem at Fannin Elementary, athletic facilities, a pothole filled, undersized parking lot at Lee where the band practices, the auditorium on the Lee campus, and the lack of preventive maintenance. Building new buildings doesn't negate the fact that a majority of the district's buildings were constructed before 1990, and there are plenty of improvements needed there. What wasn't addressed? What about Alamo Junior High or Coleman High School? While there are three comprehensive high schools, those attending the session said the bond was anything but comprehensive. There were numerous people who stated the bond didn't impact many students, including special needs students, agricultural program participants, and students on selected campuses. The process matters. Even before any of those invited to offer their comments had a chance to speak, Board President Rick Davis said, "One of the criticisms of the November bond is it felt rushed. We have been criticized for having too short of a runway." He then said he expected decisions about the next bond won't be made until mid-August 2021. Those at the meetings then provided context to why they believed a short runway was harmful. They stated that a more diverse crowd needed to be involved during creation of the plan. As one woman at the meeting at Yarborough stated, the process needs people who aren't part of a clique or considered cheerleaders because they have a different point of view. The same thing was said about making teachers more involved in the process. Board member Brian Murray told the participants at the fifth meeting at Great House that the process moving forward will include a committee with at least one person from every campus, and every part of the community will be represented. Process matters, part two. The timing of the meeting impacted the conversation because it allowed participants to bring up another point of contention. MISD has a recent history of bringing up items but not educating the community about them. At the Yarborough Elementary meeting, this was mentioned. It was during that meeting when a woman brought up Midland ISD's $9.5 million purchase of Ranchland Hills Golf Course as a reason that voters did not trust leaders as good stewards of the community. The person also reminded MISD leaders that going into the bond election, the district had more money, a great emotional argument, and the bond still failed. It was also stated there wasn't much information released before the meeting when the Ranchland Hills deal was approved, just like the waiver issue before a meeting in May. What does Arlington have to do with it? Arlington ISD's $966 million bond election, which also took place in the fall, was mentioned during three different meetings. It was first brought up when a participant made a reference to a bond person's mention of it on social media as if to say, if voters could pass it in Arlington, why not in Midland? The counterargument during a meeting was that officials with the Arlington ISD campaign did a better job of explaining and marketing their bond. The level of information Arlington ISD provided find out who helped create their plan, one person said. The Arlington bond passed by more than 33%. The marketing discussion inevitably brought up the district's decision to spend more than $100,000 on promotional/information material. Some people said it was okay for the district to provide informational material, but the cost was hard for some to understand, especially with a political action committee working alongside the district. Why couldn't Yes for Midland Kids have paid for that? One former teacher said. Culture. For the most part, these meetings were about people talking and MISD leaders listening. And during multiple meetings, the particulars of the bond, past or future, took a back seat to the people calling the shots. One man at the Days of Allah presentation stated that he was a no vote until leadership changes. He said he was not against MISD, but that he wanted better representation. There were references about teachers being pressured to vote and show their support for the bond. It was part of a greater problem, participants said, that teachers aren't comfortable being vocal about things that are wrong. They are taxpayers, said a woman at the meeting. If they are not for it, don't penalize them. There also was one woman at the meeting at Great House who pleaded with board members to stop vilifying those who don't agree with Midland ISD leadership. She said there is no reason that they should be treated like they are horrible people. The last meeting at Great House was the one that went off the script the most. Participants voiced their frustrations Moore and the board members there, Brian Murray, Tommy Bishop, and James Fuller, responded more than board members had during the previous four. Fuller, the dean of school board members, conceded that he didn't think the district had the pulse of the community in facility meetings. Bishop voiced his concerns about teachers not being able to speak freely. Murray stated, "We need to be better communicators." That meeting ended better than it started. At all meetings, participants thanked MLISD leaders for the opportunity to be heard, and the one at Great House was no different. Midland ISD leaders stated this was just the beginning and that the process will be a long one, and those wanting to participate will have the opportunity. Petition to rename Lee High School goes live by Stuart Doreen, Doreen, at HurstNP.com. A Midland man has started a petition to rename Robert E. Lee High School. Courtney Ratliff told the Reporter-Telegram on Saturday night that the petition is live at change.org. Ratliff told the Reporter-Telegram that he is heading this effort and that it should be different than the one in 2017 because he wants the petition to be limited to Lee High School graduates and Midlanders. He said that Midland ISD officials at the time said they didn't move forward with the previous petition, partially because it was created by people from outside Midland. He said the discussion is currently taking place across the nation is a factor in the timing. He also said people he has talked to have stated now is the time to make the change. "It is important to have the discussion right now," said Ratliff, a 1996 Lee graduate. "After these conversations, I feel more confident in the way I am going." The petition states that the school has for nearly 60 years provided a first-class education to the students that were blessed to walk its halls. Alumni have gone on to find success around the globe. They have served our country in the military, become scientists, doctors, and lawyers, become community leaders, created jobs by opening small businesses, and have been mothers and fathers to the next generation. However, not all alumni had the same experience while attending the school. There can be no doubt community leaders chose the name Robert E. Lee High School in 1961 as a response to the ongoing civil rights movement of the mid-20th century. For many, the name of the school, the mascot, and the Confederate symbols used to celebrate success have caused pain for decades and continue to do so. Ratliff said he expects there will be a group that will be vocal about not wanting to change the name and that history will be a reason for the sticking with the name. Ratliff has stayed involved in the local school marching band scene and talked about backlash also in 2017 when former Lee principal Stan Van Hooser called for the Lee band to stop incorporating Dixie into its school fight song. He said the band director received death threats when that happened. "Today, we are all aware of what these Confederate symbols represent and the part they play in systematic racism," the petition states. "History cannot be erased, and it must be properly acknowledged. How fortunate it is that a new future can be written. The time has come to change the name of Midland Lee High School." Please sign the petition to let Midland School Board know that the time for change is now. By signing, you add your voice to the message that the current students and citizens of Midland should be allowed to chart a new path of inclusion and support for all. Granfelt to join Reporter-Telegram as General Manager by Clarice Tui, publisher and president of Texas Community Newspapers. "It is my pleasure to announce that Robert Granfelt will be joining us on Monday as the general manager of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Panhandle properties. After many years in the distribution and digital side of media, Robert has been publisher of three community newspapers, most recently as the regional publisher for Gatehouse, West Texas, Lubbock, and Amarillo. Before that, he focused his career on specialty magazine publishing as the general manager of 360 West Magazine in Tarrant County, Fort Worth. Granfelt was the president and publisher of the Montgomery, Alabama Advertiser from 2013 through 2016. Before joining the Advertiser, he served as vice president of digital media at Southern Community Newspapers in the Atlanta area. His newspaper career started at the Lubbock Avalanche Journal newspaper in 1984. After serving in a number of circulation management positions, he transferred to the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville, where he served as the circulation marketing manager. After a brief stint as general manager of a hotel and restaurant in the British Virgin Islands, Granfelt returned to Lubbock in 1996, where he co-founded LubbockOnline.com, later serving as its director of online services. With a strong record of driving digital revenue and audience growing in Lubbock, the corporate ownership moved Granfelt to Augusta, Georgia, where he took over digital revenue leadership for Morris Digital Works, a division of the Morris Communications Corporation, a position he held for 8 years. On a personal note, Robert and his wife, Karen Granfelt, have been married since 1982, and they have 3 sons. His hobbies include working with wood and metal, scuba diving, and traveling to visit his family in the British Virgin Islands and the United Kingdom.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read articles from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Sunday, June 14th. City says MPD officer charged with family violence, from staff reports. A Midland Police Department officer has been placed on administrative suspension pending an internal investigation after her arrest early Saturday morning on a family violence charge, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. Sergeant C. McCulty has been charged with assault by contact family violence, a Class C misdemeanor, according to the release. McNulty was involved in an argument which led to her initiating unwanted contact, according to the release. This unwanted contact led to her arrest. MPD officers were dispatched at about 3 a.m. Saturday. The investigation is ongoing. City says younger than 40 makes up 63% of week's COVID-19 cases, by Stuart Doreen. The number of coronavirus cases in Midland County this week was a 58.6% increase over the previous high mark, and a big reason for that was residents younger than 40. Those 39 and younger accounted for 29 of the 46 cases reported this week by the Midland Health Department. The increase in coronavirus cases continued a trend that started this month. Last week, those age ranges made up more than half of the 26 total cases. The total number of cases this past week broke the previous high mark for a week by 17. It also pushed the total number of cases over 200. In terms of its rank across the state, Midland County is 50th overall in terms of confirmed coronavirus cases, according to the Department of State Health Services website. Midland ranks 26th in the state in terms of total population. So, despite the increase this month, Midland County is still well behind the per capita pace set across the state. The Midland Health Department also reported an increase of 13 cases that have recovered this week, bringing the total to 86. There are 73 in home isolation, 21 in nursing or rehabilitation facilities, 13 deaths, 5 in the hospital, and 3 that have completed isolation but still are not considered recovered.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.